Mr. Dodger, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You sound very well, mashallah.
Yes, alhamdulillah. I've got the flippers out here now and the surfboard is all waxed and ready. It's a great day for surfing, Maulana.
You know, when I met you, when was it? Wednesday afternoon there in the parking lot of...
I'm reading what's going to come now.
Of Crescent Towers. I thought to myself, man, this man sounds much younger than he looks.
You spoiled my whole image now.
No, that's a compliment.
Completely.
It's a compliment.
Well, you know, I've got certain qualities that I'm told are very attractive. You know, women are always looking for somebody who's tall, dark, and handsome. So at least I've got one. I'm dark.
Story that caught your eye this week.
Well, Maulana, as usual, we'll begin with the crazy stories that made it into the media. But before I get there, you know, in the old days, and I am speaking about a very long time ago, I'm only 42 years old, but I remember people saying that in those days, when a person left home, when he went to work or whatever, he made sure that his dressing was impeccable. Shirt had to be ironed perfectly, and pants had to be ironed so that it had a straight crease line, a straight line crease in front. If there was the slightest tear in the pants, it was either replaced or sent to the tailor for invisible mending. And of course, then came the era of the jeans, or as it was called in those days, dungarees. Those were also very nicely ironed and had a uniform color, either dark blue or light blue. And then we came to the era of the faded jeans. Faded jeans. Factories in China deliberately applied chemicals to jeans to get, you know, to get them to have a faded look. And then we had the abomination, the torn jeans. Can you believe it? Tears of all kinds, and they were very expensive, even with some of the threads all hanging out. You had to wear it like that. So that is bizarre, of course. Bizarre, but is generally accepted as high fashion. Torn jeans, eh? Well, I'm sure that you thought that this madness will have reached its end. Not so. Dear listeners, there's a new fashion statement regarding jeans that is just about to hit the world. A big clothing company, Nordstrom, it's a company in the good old US of A, has just launched a new type of jeans. And it is selling for $425. That's about 6,000 rands. 6,000 for a pair of jeans. So, what do they have that's different? Maybe some special embroidery with gold thread, or maybe some precious stones embedded on the pockets or something like that. What could it be, dear listeners? And here is the answer. The jeans are stained with what appears to be mud. The BBC report describes it as crackled, caked-on, muddy coating. The clothing company says the jeans are made with muddy coating that shows, in their words, that you are not afraid to get down and dirty. In fact, you can see photos of the jeans on the BBC website. Just Google it, BBC mud coated jeans, and you'll see pictures of it. Of course, the coating that looks like mud will not come off in the washing, because what would be the point if it does? Just like torn jeans, the mud has to stay. The mud has to stay. Now, dear listeners, you may think that this is crazy, but faded jeans were thought of as not catching on. Then it did, and now torn jeans are regarded as acceptable. So jeans that look like the wearer was working on a farm will be irritating you in malls all over the place in the not-too-distant future. What next after muddy jeans? Jeans that smell of cow dung or chicken droppings? The world is getting crazier by the day. Story number two. And we are still in the U.S. of A. In fact, in Cleveland, Ohio, 39-year-old Lamar Reed got a traffic fine. So he appeared in court. When he was called, he approached the judge. and he stood there as the judge looked through his documents. Mr. Reed fidgeted with his hat. Then he flipped his hat off and put it under his arm. And as he did so, a tiny plastic bag, very small one, fell off his head and tumbled to the ground. A few minutes later, Reed left the court with a small traffic fine. After an hour later, the court's security officer saw the small packet and he picked it up. It had a white powdery substance inside. The officer sent it for testing. It was cocaine. A warrant was issued, and a short while later, Reed was arrested and now faces a long sentence in jail. So, dear listeners, it is the unanimous decision of the Committee for the Determination of Ulluness that Limar Reed is the undisputed Mampara of the week. But just hang on. I'm not quite finished yet. One quick story, Maulana. In the northwest of China is the province of Xinjiang. It has a population of 20 million, with more than half of them being Muslim. The government officials of this province have issued a declaration that a newborn baby cannot be given certain names. Names that are banned are Jihad, Imam, Makkah, Saddam, and Hajj. Because, in the words of the banning order, these names can exaggerate religious fervor. And if you happen to keep any one of these names for your baby, then the child will be banned from the hukou, which is the household registration system used throughout China, effectively denying the child access to public health care and education. Now look, I can understand that the name Jihad may make the lighty grow up and go and fight somewhere or something, but Imam? And what about Makkah or Hajj? Hey, I don't know about you, Maulana, but I haven't met a child called Makkah or even Hajj. Imagine saying, Kuchik, Kuchik, go Hajj, Hajj, Kuchik. Hey, you, tell the parents, hey, your Makkah looks so cute today, eh? So is it allowed to keep the name Umrah, for example, for the baby? I would suggest that the Chinese Muslims got many inspiring names to choose from. That, well, inspiring in the way that they will, as they say, exaggerate religious fervor. For example, Salahuddin, or Saiful Islam, or Khalid bin Walid. What about Osama? They left that one out. So I have to conclude, dear listeners, that these silly government officials have taken out their fatwa from the batwa. My China's.
The French elections.
Well, France has produced some real characters. We can never forget that silly fellow, the ex-president Nicolas Sarkozy. And the current president is, of course, Francois Hollande. President Hollande is on his way out. Elections are taking place in France. And a few days ago, the French voted for 11 candidates, and if any one of them managed to receive 51%, then he or she would be the president. But it did not happen. None of them got more than 50%. So the two candidates who got the highest votes will now go to the next round of voting on the 7th of May. So, who are the two candidates? They are Macaroni and Penne. Did you hear that? Macaroni and penne. Just in case you think that a bowl of pasta will be the next president, let me clear that up. The two candidates are Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen. Makes me hungry just thinking about them. So on May 7th, one of them will be elected president. Okay, let's look at who is the better of the two. As far as Muslims are concerned, well, there are in fact around 6.5 million Muslims in France in a total population of 60 million. So, these Muslims of France, the last time they voted for Francois Hollande because he seemed to be more left-wing, he seemed to care about minorities. So, in fact, surprisingly, about 93% of Muslims voted for him against Sarkozy, who was seen as anti-Muslim with his burqa ban and so on. So, who are the Muslims of France going to vote for on May 7th? Actually, Maulana, it's quite a dilemma. Let's first take Emmanuel Macron. He is a close friend of Israel and has promised to be even closer once he becomes president. He is, here's some information from the Jerusalem Post. It says here, Israeli politicians across the political map boast of friendship with the French presidential candidate, expressing their support ahead of the second round of elections. Israeli politicians who have met Emmanuel Macron said Monday they are impressed with the French presidential candidate. Macron was in Israel on September 2015 when he was economy minister and met with his economy counterpart Aryeh Deri. Macron met Labour Party leadership candidate, the leadership for the president of Israel, Labour Party leadership candidate Erel Margalit, when he came to Jerusalem, which led to an invitation to Margalit to meet with Macron and French President François Hollande at the Élysée Palace. Margalit, who was a high-tech entrepreneur before he entered politics, said the two have met four or five times, sometimes spending a full day together discussing innovation. He said, if Macron is elected, France will embark on an innovation economy and Israel will be at the center of its economic cooperation. And there's another guy, Yesh Atid, from the Yesh Atid party in Israel. His name is Yair Lapid. Posted a statement on Facebook calling Macron my friend and calling upon voters to ensure his victory over Le Pen. He says, although we don't get involved in elections in other countries, this time I will make an exception. Anyone who has the right to vote in Israel or in France needs to support Macron against Marine Le Pen in the second round. He wrote this on his Facebook page. So, you see, dear listeners. Anyway, let's look at Madame Le Pen. Now, Le Pen, and let me just read some of her statements. Le Pen addressed thousands of supporters in the southwest French city of Bordeaux, where she vowed to, in her words, uncompromisingly fight Islamist fundamentalism, which seeks to impose its oppressive rules in our country. She also criticized the headscarf that some Muslim women wear, saying, girls in France should be able to dress as they wish and shouldn't be forced to bury themselves under clothes of another age. And she said at a recent campaign rally, in France, we respect women. We don't beat them. We don't ask them to hide themselves behind a veil as if they were impure. We drink wine when we want. We can criticize religion and speak freely. Her comments were a clear jab at Muslims. That was the report. So you see, dear listeners, what I mean about the dilemma facing the French Muslims, it's almost like what's happening here. Do we vote for the ANC, which brought in democracy, but is perceived to be corrupt at the top? Or do we vote for the DA, which is viewed as promoting good governance, but is also seen as a party for white interests, and of course is perceived as being pro-Israel? So it's like being in an Italian restaurant, Molana. What shall I order, macaroni or penne? But you know, either one will, but of course you will know that either one of them will give you indigestion. That's the talk in France at the moment, voting for the lesser of the two evils. Or, and this may be the choice for many Muslims, don't vote at all.
Now, moving on to Donald Trump.
Well, then, I don't think that there's any week will pass without me speaking about my good friend, Donald. He gives me lots of material for this program. But first, let's go to Britain. The foreign minister, Boris Johnson, he's another loudmouth with a silly hairstyle. He described Jeremy Corbyn, who is the leader of the opposition Labour Party, as a mutton-headed old mugwump.
Ooh.
Mutton-headed old mugwump. Let's examine that. Mutton-headed. Well, mutton as in sheep. So just as you say, hey, you've got goat brains, this is mutton-headed. So what is mugwump? M-U-G-W-U-M-P. Mugwump. Well, no one really knows. The Guardian newspaper looked for definitions and found this. According to the Webster Dictionary, there are two definitions. A bolter from the Republican Party in 1884, and also another definition, a person who is independent as in politics or who remains undecided or neutral. The dictionary says mugwump is an anglicized version of a word used by Massachusetts Indians to mean war leader. The word was sometimes jestingly applied in early America to someone who was the head guy. And it continues, the first political mugwumps were Republicans in the presidential race of 1884 who chose to support Democratic candidate Grover Cleveland rather than their own party's nominee. The Oxford English Dictionary described a mugwump as one who holds more or less aloof from party politics, professing disinterest or superior views. So there you are, some useless information, dear listeners. Well, whatever the definition, I like the sound of that description. Mutton-headed old mugwump. My definition of that is that it means a first-class laddu.
Hmm.
Boris Johnson's close friend is our man Donald Trump. There is no doubt that Donald Trump is a mutton-headed old mugwump. But dear listeners, today, I don't want to be hard on him, on my friend Donald. In fact, I have some words of praise for him. I can see some eyebrows are lifting, and hi, Bo, what is AB smoking? But there's a good story. It was reported in the Washington Post. Here's some extracts. Do you have a few minutes, Mola?
Yes, go for it.
The article says, does Trump have us all fooled with his anti-Islam stance? In President Donald Trump's first week of office, after he signed an executive order on what has been called a Muslim ban, he said that he would prioritize the protection of persecuted Christians. But his first big international rescue of an American citizen was a Muslim woman. Aya Hijazi, a 30-year-old U.S.-Egyptian dual citizen, was released last week after spending nearly 3 years in an Egyptian prison. That Trump helped make it happen has surprised some Muslims in the United States, many of whom have considered his administration openly hostile towards them. Hijazi, who grew up in Falls Church, which is a town in Virginia, and graduated from George Mason University, started a foundation aiming to shelter and rehabilitate street children in Egypt. She and others from her foundation were taken into custody in 2014 and imprisoned on child abuse and trafficking charges that human rights workers and U.S. officials widely dismissed as false. Hijazi was acquitted last week after backroom negotiations between the Trump administration and representatives of the Egyptian government. In an interview published on Sunday, Trump asked Associated Press reporter Julie Pace, "Did you see Aya?" When asked if he could describe how the release had come about, Trump said, "No, just, you know, I asked the government to let her out. Obama worked on it for 3 years, and he got zero. The Obama administration unsuccessfully tried to pressure the Egyptian government for a release. Earlier this month, Trump embraced Sisi at the White House, calling him fantastic and offering the U.S. government strong backing. Last week, Trump dispatched a U.S. government aircraft to Cairo to bring Hijazi and her family to Washington. Mohammed Sultan, a U.S. citizen and former political prisoner in Egypt, said Trump's work on behalf of Hijazi makes him hopeful that the president could change his direction on Muslims. So, dear listeners, what do you make of that, eh? Is our mutton-headed old mugwump going to become Muslim-friendly? And, of course, the biggest question is, will he give me a visa?
Israel and Palestine.
Well, today I'm not going to say bad things about Israel. In fact, I'm going to say something complimentary. Now you are definitely convinced that I got some potent green stuff from the trans guy. Well, let me say this. Everywhere in the so-called Western world, as Europe and the United States and so on, the word Sharia law is regarded as a very dirty word, a boogeyman. Sharia is used to scare people. Many states in the United States pass laws against Sharia because The right-wing groups have made the frightening claim that Muslims are trying to bring in Sharia to replace the U.S. Constitution. Anyway, I was quite surprised to read that there are Sharia courts in Israel. Wow. And the headline in the Jerusalem Post says, Israeli Sharia court system appoints first ever female judge. It says here, the Sharia courts in Israel handle personal status law, law issues like marriage and divorce for Muslim Israelis. Israel's Sharia courts on Tuesday appointed Hannah Khatib as the first female judge in the Muslim system's history. The country's rabbinic courts still have yet to appoint a female judge, though there are a smattering of women on local rabbinical councils. The Sharia court system in Israel handles personal status issues like marriage and divorce for Muslims and has functioned on an uninterrupted basis since Ottoman times, including when Israel was established in 1948. In 1961, the Knesset brought the Sharia courts into Israel's system, and they are connected to the Justice Ministry. They handle an average of 36,000 cases per year, with the Jerusalem Sharia court hearing about 20 cases per day. Khatib is an expert in Sharia law who has two advanced degrees, lives in Tamara, and is married with four children. The first requirement to apply to become a Sharia court judge in Israel, or Qadi, is that candidates must live their lives according to Sharia law and either have already practiced 6 years as a lawyer or spent at least 6 years learning Sharia law at a university in or outside of Israel recognized by the Education Ministry. Next, candidates must pass a written exam of expertise in Sharia law and pass a public vetting process and be chosen by a 9-person committee similar to the 9-person committee that chooses Israel's civil court judges. I'm sure, dear listeners, that you are as surprised to learn this as I am. In fact, quite thought-provoking, eh, Maulana? And that's where we leave it this week, dear listeners. No bad word about mutton-headed old mugwump, and no bad word about Israel. And now, please, let me get back to my hookah.
Light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, Maulana, Maulana was giving a fiery lecture at the masjid in Overport about death and the hereafter.
Mm-hmm.
Maulana said, all of you musallis of this masjid will die and face judgment on Qiyamah Day. There was a fellow sitting in the front and he had a big smile on his face. And the Maulana continued with his lecture and said, all of you musallis of this masjid will face the fire for all your gunars. The man's smile got wider. Finally, at the end of his lecture, Maulana said, and the most deadly snakes will bite you with the most painful venom. So, dear musallis of this masjid, take heed and change your ways. The man now had a huge grin on his face. And the Maulana was quite irritated by now and stopped his lecture and asked the fellow, so, what are you so happy about? And the Laddu replied, Maulana, I'm not a musalli of this masjid. I'm from Joburg. One last word. Now, as we all know very well, crime is on the increase. Last week, a lady was found dead in a kitchen in Binoni. Police found a big box of Weet-Bix next to her body, Maulana. This was apparently used to beat her repeatedly on the head. And a few days later, also in Leedsville, Binoni, a man was found dead in his lounge. He was repeatedly hit with a box of cornflakes. And this morning, I just heard that a teenager was found dead. This time it was, he was hit on the head with a box of Cocoa Pops. That was the weapon that was used. Police spokesman Alvin Munsami said, they are looking for a serial killer.
Uncle AB, as always, Jazakumullah for your time. Much appreciated.
Always a pleasure, Maulana. See you on the beach on the south coast.
Inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.